This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're continuing our look at the National Park Experience with Yellowstone. It's the world's very first national park, established in 1872. Little has changed inside the park since, but the American population and its concept of wilderness have. Seven people have died in bear-related encounters at Yellowstone in the last 100 years, three of them since 2011. In the most recent case, the bear was trapped and killed, raising questions about humans think about and interact with untamed wilderness, and whether we expect nature to be contained or managed by human rules. David Quammen is an author of 15 books now on science, nature, and travel. He wrote in depth about these issues and others at Yellowstone for the Yellowstone issue of National Geographic. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Virginia. Good to be with you.
Let's start with some of the basics. What sets Yellowstone apart from other American national parks?
Well, as you said, it is the first national park created in America, created in the world. It's also the largest national park in the lower 48 states, and it is part of a still larger ecosystem. Yellowstone itself is about 2 million acres, but the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is about 22 million acres. That's an area that includes national forests, wildlife refuges, some other public land, some big private ranches and other private land, most of it in a fairly wild state. So what's unique about Yellowstone is that there is this huge area of contiguous, fairly wild and some very wild landscape in the middle of the American West, surrounded on all sides by towns like the one I live in, and malls and highways and golf courses. In the midst of that sits this huge wild place filled with grizzly bears and other spectacular wildlife.
Yeah, and it's photographs from a 19th century exhibition headed by the U.S. Geological Survey of Territories that first showed people back east what that looked like. So why were they so captivated and moved to even press the president to protect this land so far away?
Well, it was photographs, but also paintings by the painter Thomas Moran. This was the 1870s, after all, and news and impressions moved in a very different, much slower way. So Moran and a photographer named Jackson brought back their images, and it was not wildlife that inspired the creation of Yellowstone. At the beginning, it was scenic splendor. It was the fact that here was a place with geysers, bubbling mineral springs, deep canyons, spectacular waterfalls. So it was scenic splendor that caused first the Northern Pacific Railroad to think, well, this would be great if this were a national park. We could sell train tickets and hotel rooms to people who wanted to come out and see it. And eventually Congress embraced that idea and created this park, and President Grant signed the bill in 1872.
And back east, they did have this example of Niagara Falls, you know, completely commercialized. So this idea of preserving wildness was part of it. And this is what you call, or part of what you call, the paradox of the park. You know, Yellowstone gives us a view into American wilderness, but in this way that's kind of contained and sanctioned. What's going on there in that paradox?
That's right. Yeah, actually, in the text, I call it the paradox of the cultivated wild. The paradox of the cultivated wild is my way of referring to this odd situation where we have, as a society, we have drawn a rectangular box around a piece of landscape, the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park, and we have said, inside this area, we will keep things wild, we will keep things as they have been for centuries and millennia, and outside of those boundaries, we will let progress proceed. That is paradoxical. How do we do that? How do we manage a landscape, animals, ecosystem processes in a way such that they can remain wild? That's the paradox. We're managing it, and yet it is intended to remain wild. Mm. We're talking about natural regulation, another paradoxical term for this. Is it natural or is it regulated? It's a difficult paradox that we've been dealing with ever since 1872.
And one of the sort of dramatic illustrations of that is the growth of both animal and human populations at Yellowstone, increasing their interactions. As we mentioned, three deaths because of grizzlies since 2011. What can you tell us about these recent cases?
Well, first of all, that they're very rare events. It doesn't happen very often. More people die of other causes, falling into hot pots, being struck by lightning, being struck by cars. So the chance that a person will be attacked and killed by a grizzly bear in Yellowstone Park is very, very small. But it does happen occasionally. People make mistakes. Bears make mistakes, and these unfortunate encounters occur. As you said, there were two such in 2011. After the second one, a female bear was implicated as probably having caused both of those, and in the second case, she ate part of the human victim, and so she was killed. She was put down. In the summer of 2015, we had one more case. A man was killed while hiking alone without bear spray, which was a mistake on his part. He was attacked apparently by a female with cubs. In any case, he was killed, and she fed on him and her cubs fed on him, and they stashed the remains of his body. And because of that, because they had fed on human flesh and treated humans as food, it was decided that she had to be killed and her cubs were moved out of the park.
Which, of course, is something that, you know, is natural for a bear to cache their kill.
It is. That means that she was thinking of him as food, and that's why the park managers decided that it was too dangerous to allow her to stay in the population, something that they do very reluctantly, but it happens occasionally.
Yeah, I'm thinking visitors to the park in the 1870s, you know, they knew a lot about bears. Now Americans have this concept of a park that includes SeaWorld, Disney World, you know, water parks. I mean, I'm not by any means blaming the victims here, but do you think they were prepared to be in this kind of environment?
Well, evidently not, if this particular man, if he wasn't carrying bear spray. He was an experienced hiker. He worked in the park. It seems as though he would have known better, although we really can't judge him. But people tend to think of wild animals in the park as though they were on the other side of a plexiglass window, as though they were parts of a diorama. But again, as I say in the issue, the diorama is real. There is no plexiglass. And if you walk 100 yards, 200 yards off the road in Yellowstone Park, you are in the Wild West amid dangerous animals, and you should be taking precautions, traveling in a group, carrying bear spray. When people visit game parks in East Africa, the Serengeti or the Maasai Mara Park, where there are lions and leopards, they don't get out of their tour vans or their Land Rovers and go walking or backpacking across the country. But in America, we do things differently, so we allow that to happen.
We're talking about Yellowstone National Park as a sort of emblematic of the battle for the American West. The entire May issue of National Geographic is dedicated to the park, and David Quammen is with us. He's a science, nature, and travel writer who wrote in depth about Yellowstone and that very paradox. So let's talk about some of the other ways this kind of a paradox of the cultivated wild plays out. Bison, so emblematic of the American West. So they're protected within the park, but once they step outside, not so much. And how do ranchers view them?
That's right. The bison, of course, was almost driven extinct in the American West in the late 19th century, and it was saved in Yellowstone Park. About 20 bison survived in a backcountry valley of Yellowstone. The population has been brought back up. There are now thousands of bison in Yellowstone. In fact, there are too many for the habitat during the winter. So in winter, they migrate down out of the highlands of Yellowstone. Yellowstone is very high, sits on a plateau, very cold, very severe in the winter. So bison and other ungulates migrate down. But when bison migrate out of the park, they face treatment in the state of Montana as livestock, not as wildlife. That's because they carry an infectious agent for a disease known as brucellosis. This is something that was brought in originally by cattle. Now the bison have it, and it's feared that they will transmit it back to disease-free cattle. So the state of Montana will not allow bison to migrate into the state, bringing this infection. They're stopped. They're rounded up. They're shipped to slaughter, meat going to Indian tribes and the Intertribal Bison Council. There's a small exception made, but essentially, bison are animals non grata in the state of Montana. They are no longer considered wildlife. They're considered a threat to the livestock industry.
So how did they get along with this, you know, these living ranches, these economic engines of the West, these cities that are sprouting up in the West and gaining in population? How does a park as vast as Yellowstone coexist?
Well, this is where the ecosystem aspect comes in. In addition to the park itself and Grand Teton National Park, there are these other lands. There are national forest lands. There are big private ranches. There's some Bureau of Land Management land. So it has been realized that Yellowstone Park cannot exist without the rest of the ecosystem, and the rest of the ecosystem with its wildlife and its processes can't exist without Yellowstone Park. There is this essential interconnectedness. So the management of those other lands, the national forests, the BLM lands, even the management of the private ranches, are essential factors in the survival of the wildlife of Yellowstone Park. For instance, the elk migrate down out of the highlands of Yellowstone Park onto big private ranches generally during the winter. The ranchers who own those ranches, at least the most enlightened and patient of them, tolerate those elk, hundreds and hundreds of elk in some cases, eating the grass that they are growing for their livestock. If it weren't for those big private ranches, if those places were sold off, subdivided, developed, turned into more sprawl, then the Yellowstone elk migrations essentially will be stopped, will be interrupted, and the highlands of Yellowstone will not have those great elk populations even in the summer.
So you're talking about a systemic way of thinking of it, but I'm thinking as you're speaking of the whole American concept of, you know, the conquest of land, the conquest of the West, which grew the nation. And if we want to be honest, you know, the subjugation and conquest of people as well as land, if we're talking about the Native Americans. Is there something bigger here that we can maybe enforce rules inside of a park? But is there something bigger here that we can't legislate about the whole human concept of owning or taming nature?
Well, I would say yes, and that also is paradoxical. That gets back to what I call the paradox of the cultivated wild. We can't conquer nature and yet still have nature as wild, magnificent, spectacular, unbridled. We want it both ways. But Yellowstone is not a zoo. So if you want the spectacle and the majesty and the intactness of a great natural ecosystem with the big carnivores like the grizzly bear and the wolf and the mountain lion, then you have to realize that those animals do not obey human rules. They do not respect invisible boundaries drawn as straight lines on a map, and they do not respect the fact that this particular animal that looks like food to them might be a cow owned by some rancher. It's difficult. It requires patience. It requires compromise. It requires negotiation of all these things, one human party with another, and negotiating in a sense with the animals. And at the bottom of all that, I think it requires humility, us realizing that there's only so much we can arrange for our own convenience and our own pleasure. And if we want wild nature, then at a certain point we have to realize that it's not entirely controllable.
David Quammen, science, nature, and travel writer, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Pleasure to talk with you today, Virginia.
David wrote about Yellowstone for the Yellowstone issue of National Geographic. Note the subtitle of the issue, The Battle for the American West. And there are some fantastic, fantastic photos. There's more at wordofmouthradio.org.
Every summer, thousands of pleasure-seeking tourists head for the great outdoor playgrounds of America. And a favorite spot is this wonderland of nature called Yellowstone National Park. But while these eager beaver motorists are trying to get into beautiful Yellowstone Park, one rugged individualist is trying to get out.
I have had it, boo-boo. I'm gonna bust out of here.
How come, Yogi?
Every day it's the same old thing. Look at the bears, look at the bears, look at the bears. Shh.
Hey, Pop!